Welcome to Storied Ground, a Northwest Ohio history podcast, where we enlist our region's many historical sites and markers as our guides to rediscovering the past around us in all its wonder, diversity, and complexity. I'm your host, Nick Pavlik.
The Indians believe the whites were made by the same Great Spirit who created them, and that he assigned to each, a different race of men, a particular employment in this world, but not the same to all. To the whites, the Great Spirit gave it in the charge to till the ground and raise by cultivation the fruits of the earth. To the Indians, he assigned the nobler employment of hunting and the supreme domination over all the rest of the animal creation. It is true, they confess, that when they first saw the whites, they took them for beings of a superior kind. They did not know but that they had been sent to them from the abode of the Great Spirit for some great and important purpose. They therefore welcomed them, hoping to be made happier by their company. It was not long, however, before they discovered their mistake, having found them an ungrateful, insatiable people, who, though the Indians had given them as much land as was necessary to raise provisions for themselves and their families, and pasture for their cattle, wanted still to have more, and at last would not be contented with less than the whole country. And yet, say those injured people, these white men would always be telling us of their great book which God had given to them. They would persuade us that every man was good who believed in what the book said, and that every man was bad who did not believe in it. They told us a great many things, which they said were written in the good book, and wanted us to believe it all. We would probably have done so if we had seen them practice what they pretended to believe, and act according to the good words which they told us. But no. While they held their big book in one hand, in the other, they had murderous weapons, guns, and swords, wherewith to kill us. They killed those who believed in their book, as well as those who did not. They made no distinction. Reverend John Heckwelder.
In the year 1818, the Reverend John Gottlieb Ernestus Heckwelder published a history of the indigenous peoples of the American Mid-Atlantic region, particularly the Lenni Lenape, also known as the Delaware. Under the title History, Manners, and Customs of the Indian Nations Who Once Inhabited Pennsylvania and the Neighboring States, Heckwelder's work was informed by his experiences as a Moravian missionary living among the Delaware and other native peoples in Pennsylvania and Ohio in the latter 18th century, during which he witnessed unspeakable events of violence and bloodshed as the newly formed United States sought to expand into the Ohio Country, America's first western frontier, and was met with fierce resistance by the land's native inhabitants who were determined to defend their territory from American encroachment in the decade-long conflict historians now refer to as the Northwest Indian War. By the time of the publication of Heckwelder's history, the United States had resoundingly defeated the many indigenous nations of Ohio who had bound together to repel the Americans from their homelands. The American victory against the tribes and their British allies at the Battle of Fallen Timbers in 1794 in present-day Maumee precipitated the signing of the Treaty of Greenville in 1795, which effectively ended the Northwest Indian War and established an official north-south boundary line delineating Indian and American territory in Ohio. 8 years later, in 1803, Ohio was ushered in as America's 17th state. And as a portent of events to come further west later in the 19th century, the Greenville Treaty line eventually withered away under the relentless course of American expansion. The War of 1812 brought further chaos and devastation to Ohio's native peoples. And in 1817, just 1 year before the publication of Heckwelder's history, The Treaty of Fort Meigs forced Ohio's remaining indigenous inhabitants onto reserves in northwest Ohio that were utter fragments of their once vast territory. Within 15 years after the passing of President Andrew Jackson's Indian Removal Act in 1830, Ohio's indigenous nations had all been removed to Indian territory in present-day Kansas and Oklahoma, where they hoped they would at last be free of American intervention. It was in this context that the Reverend John Heckwelder published his recounting of his experiences living among the Delaware and other indigenous tribes during a time of great upheaval and trauma for Ohio's native peoples. And while his work was primarily intended to be a firsthand account of the histories and cultural traditions of the indigenous tribes who once inhabited the land that had become Pennsylvania and Ohio, it is not surprising, given the bonds of friendship Heckwelder had developed with the people to whom he had long ministered in the Ohio country, that it also at times reads as a lamentation for a long-lost age, when the ambitions of the American colonies, and later the nascent American Republic, were tempered by the military and diplomatic prowess of powerful Indian nations. Indeed, Heckwelder's work is characteristic of many Native American histories of the 19th century written by white authors, who, now at a safe enough distance from a past scarred by brutal warfare between indigenous nations and American forces, looked back at the Native peoples who had once inhabited their land with a sense of earnest respect, fascination, nostalgia, and regret, viewing their defeat and removal as the tragic but inevitable consequence of American manifest destiny. But was it inevitable? The passage from Heckwelder's history we heard moments ago certainly seems to suggest that it was, and indeed would not be at all out of place in the predominant narrative by which the history of U.S.-Indian relations is understood and remembered today, the general arc of which is that the inherent conflicts between indigenous and American lifeways and values, along with the United States' ruthless drive for westward expansion and imperial conquest at any cost, was bound to lead to a violent clash of civilizations, resulting in the decimation and removal of Native peoples under the military and industrial might of the United States. There is undoubtedly a great deal of truth to this narrative, of course. But if we examine the history of U.S.-Indian relations in Ohio, particularly with respect to the Wyandot people, the question of whether Indian removal was inevitable becomes more complicated. It was in Ohio, the crucible of the first American Western frontier, where the proving ground was laid for the first iteration of U.S.-Indian policy, the aim of which, at the time, was not to remove Native peoples from their homelands, but to incorporate them into the American experiment, providing them with the resources with which to transform their societies in accordance with Anglo-American institutions, such as settled agriculture, private property and capital, and Christianity, until eventually the cultural distinctions between indigenous and white peoples in America would dissolve. While most Ohio tribes understandably rejected this vision and resolved to instead leave Ohio in hopes of preserving their traditional lifeways, the Wyandot adapted and flourished on their Grand Reserve in Upper Sandusky for nearly 30 years, becoming among the wealthiest and most respected people in Ohio through their dealings with the American government, while never sacrificing their cultural sovereignty as Wyandot. This episode of Storied Ground is part one of a three-part series on the history of the Wyandot in Ohio, from their arrival in the early 18th century to their departure later in the 19th century, and to their extraordinary return in the present day. The Wyandot story reveals how, in the midst of all the deadly violence between American forces and indigenous peoples that marks the history of the Ohio frontier, there were also actors on both sides who were committed to achieving a peaceful coexistence among their peoples, and how, for a brief historical moment, the Wyandot in Northwest Ohio seemed poised to become the model of how indigenous peoples could live prosperously alongside white American settlers while retaining their tribal cultures and identities. This momentary glimpse of what could have been with respect to the history of U.S.-Indian relations in Ohio makes the eventual removal of the Wyandot in 1843 all the more tragic. But as we'll come to learn, The Wyandot have never lost the memory of their ancestors who fought for the survival of their nation in Ohio in defiance of aggressors from all sides in a time of rapid and seismic change for their people. For the Wyandot, Ohio will always remain home. As one historian so astutely wrote of the removal of the Wyandot and other native peoples of Ohio, while the conflict between Jackson and the Cherokee, as well as with the other southern tribes, reads like a mythic battle between good and evil, the struggle of Ohio's historic Indians to find a place for themselves in a rapidly changing world comes closer to the tragedies of Shakespeare. There is no black and white scenario of perfect characters on one side to root for, nor wholly evil characters on the other side to condemn. Instead, there is only the tale of many individuals who tried to come to terms with the fast pace of change on America's western frontier. While they often disagreed with one another on how to proceed, they all attempted to move toward the best possible future. In the end, Ohio became a microcosm of how people with conflicting views and competing interests strove to find the surest way forward, even in the face of the relentless press of time. Fortunately, the author of these words is one of our guest experts for this three-part series on the history of the Wyandot in Ohio.
My name is Mary Stockwell, and I'm a longtime resident of Ohio. And I have a PhD in American history, and I trained with some of the top guys in the American West. So the frontier in the West, to me, is synonymous with America. I was a professor for many years at Lawrence University, and then I took early retirement. I said, I'm going to see if I can write all my books.
And write books she has. Over the last decade, she has authored three major works of history on the development and consequences of the policies underlying the American government's relations with indigenous peoples, including Unlikely General, Mad Anthony Wayne and the Battle for America from Yale University Press, Interrupted Odyssey, Ulysses S. Grant and the American Indians from Southern Illinois University Press, and from Westholm Publishing, The Other Trail of Tears, The Removal of the Ohio Indians. Throughout her esteemed career as a scholar, writer, and teacher, Dr. Stockwell has endeavored to tell the democratic history of the early American Republic that incorporates the many perspectives and experiences of the diverse peoples and cultures who have shaped the American story.
Learning as Americans to tell our story with everybody in it, it is not easy. Another great historian, John Lukács, a European historian, I never forgot his article. He said, it's easy to write a nation from the point of view of the kings, but to tell real democratic history where everybody's in it and you have to tell everybody's viewpoint and you're weaving all these stories together to say, this is who we are now. He said, that's brutal, but that's what American historians have to do.
However, Dr. Stockwell also cautions against viewing the history of America's westward expansion into Ohio and beyond through the lens of a single theoretical framework, such as that of settler colonialism, that advances a totalizing explanation of an often unsettling past, and thereby risks misrepresenting or distorting its complex realities and the conflicting viewpoints and divergent experiences of those who actually lived through it.
That's a very nice perspective from French deconstructionism, but it bears no resemblance to what people actually lived through.
So. Yeah, what it was actually like, especially for ordinary people.
And it's left people today disengaged from the past. It's like they can analyze everything wrong with the world and the United States. And then I sometimes ask people, well, now where do you live in this perfected world where you're not tied to all these people in the past? I tell people, don't be puritanical. You can't be a Puritan and think all those people back there were evil. No. They were just like we are today, struggling, and struggling more than we now are willing to admit to try to figure out a way to live together. The United States was weak. To be an American citizen, you were in a weak position compared to the power of the tribes and the power of the British Empire. The tribes were aligned with the British Empire, and we were still fighting for the future. Does democracy even have a place on the North American continent? And not every tribe agreed on what to do. You got to listen to these people themselves. What did they say? We're going to have to begin to study history as people actually lived it, not in this abstract dream of how we think they lived it.
Sure.
People aren't abstract things. They're on the ground trying to live their lives. And if you view history from that perspective, it comes alive.
Thanks to historical records preserved in archives throughout the U.S. and other parts of the world, historians like Dr. Stockwell are able to study and interpret the myriad perspectives of those who represented the young United States in its encounters with the Wyandot. But what about the perspectives of the Wyandot people? These are not nearly as well documented in surviving historical records. Yet, if we are to truly heed Dr. Stockwell's call and tell the democratic history of American and Wyandot relations in Ohio, it is essential that we understand how that history has been remembered by the Wyandot themselves.
I said, "Hello, my friends. My name is Tupaz, is my Wyandot name, Two Lives. I said that I am Wyandot and I'm of the Big Turtle Clan."
Chris Houck, or Two Paths, is a Lifeways researcher at the Wyandot Nation's Cultural Center and Museum in Wyandot, Oklahoma, where for years he has been dedicated to the work of rediscovering and documenting the ancient lifeways of his people. As an educator, Houck frequently engages with public audiences to teach and demonstrate the Wyandot's historical and cultural traditions, and to instill a greater public understanding of the Wyandot story and their place in the shaping of American history.
We originally were comprised of four different tribes: the people of the Bear, the people of the Deer, people of the Rock, and the people of the Cord. And there are even another one they say are the people of the Bog. We all lived together but separate. One group was referred to as the Patoon by the French, which is the tobacco people. They grew a lot of tobacco for trade. But we started out between the Georgian Bay of Lake Huron and Lake Simcoe. That is our original homelands.
You might have heard Chris Houck reference that he is a member of the Big Turtle Clan. From the very beginning, in Wyandot society, one's clan affiliation was a vitally important aspect of their personal, familial, and tribal identity.
The clans were the tribe. The tribe was not made up of clans. The clans were the absolute basis. The clans were divided into fratries. We have the fur animals, your bear and your porcupine and deer and all of these. And then you have the turtle clans, which we had Big Turtle, Little Turtle, Mud Turtle, Striped Turtle. So we had a lot of turtle clans. And in the old days, you could not marry someone within your same fratry, certainly not your clan, because every woman was mother. Every girl woman was sister in these clans. So if I wanted to get married, I would marry someone from the fur animal side. In our longhouse, there were the fur animals on the east, and I sit with the turtles on the west. We're matrilineal. You follow your mother's side. My mother's Big Turtle, I'm Big Turtle.
The lineage of the clans continues to be an integral part of life within the Wyandot Nation today, and is reflective of the revered status of women within Wyandot society.
Women are very blessed. They're very sacred to us. Clan chiefs were appointed by the clan mothers. They ran the clans. They chose who sat at council. Granted, the council may have all been male chiefs, but they did what the clan mothers said. And if they didn't, they would be gotten rid of and they'd find somebody that would follow the rules.
Unfortunately, as a result of the collective trauma experienced by the Wyandot over centuries, there is some cultural knowledge with respect to the ancestral origins of the clans that has been lost. What are the origins of the clans within the Wyandot?
Nobody really knows. We do know the Big Turtle Clan is one of the oldest. A gentleman by the name of William Connolly wrote a lot about us in Kansas in particular. He talked about 12 clans. But then there are other clans that are listed by the Jesuits, the Snipe Clan and the Sturgeon Clan. These were such big things, but there were only 12 that he knew of. There are about 7 or 8 left now. For example, the Mud Turtle Clan, I thought they were extinct. They're not. I met a lady that, "Oh, well, I'm Mud Turtle." It's like, wow, you know. I thought there weren't that many Snake Clan, but I found out that there are quite a few of the Snake Clan around. But a lot of times you don't know someone's clan unless they tell you. But a lot of people don't have any idea what their clan is, which is sad.
And then there are some clans that are more conclusively known to have gone extinct.
There was a story about how the last member of the Highland Turtle Clan, she was the last one, she was on her deathbed. And they said, "You're the last one. Do you want us to refill with white adoptees or people from other clans or She said, bury it with me. Bury it with me, because that was the end of them. The thing is, the Highland Turtle Clan, most of them have been executed for practicing black magic. Magic was a capital crime in the Wyandot, black magic. And there's a story of how a bunch of them gathered at the spring and they were doing magic. And anyway, they were caught. And that entire group of like 50 people was executed. And that's what had happened to a lot of the Highland or Prairie Turtle Clan. They had to be executed.
Organized into matrilineal clans, the Wyandot lived for many generations on their original homelands in present-day southern Ontario, Canada, subsisting on their traditional lifeways based around semi-permanent agricultural settlements.
We started out in the old ways. We lived in longhouses, big bark houses, and we would go and we would move about every 12 to 15 years, maybe 20 sometimes, because we were farmers predominantly. We grew the three sisters, which is corn, beans, and squash. They are somewhat labor intensive. It takes a community to raise things in that way, in mounds that have these three things together. And you have to calculate, each person was eating probably close to a pound of food a day. So the community was so important. You had to have community or nobody would eat. You'd go hungry in the winter. The farming was mostly done by the women. The men didn't just sit around. The French seemed to think they did. They used to just sit around and smoke tobacco, and that's not necessarily the case.
In fact, Wyandot men were widely regarded by other indigenous tribes and later by European colonizers as fiercely skilled and intelligent warriors and diplomats.
The men, they cleared fields and built longhouses and hunting and things like that, but they also conducted a lot of war. We were constantly at war with somebody. If we were allies, we were allies. You had none better. But if we were enemies, you didn't want to have any problem with the Wyandots. We tried to get along with everybody, but if we didn't need to get along with people, no problem. There are stories that were a lot about war. We even went down and fought the Cherokee at one point. We didn't always come out on top, but more often than not, we did. And a lot of times it involved trickery, deceit, duplicity. Those were very Wyandot qualities. If I can paraphrase the British, they said, you know, the Wyandots are the most feared of all the savage nations, not so much for their numbers, but for their intelligence. If you've seen our logo, the more modern one, you'll notice there's a tomahawk in one claw of the big turtle and a peace pipe in the other. We're ready for war or peace at all times. What do you want to do? So that's how we operate.
Though powerful militarily, the Wyandot, like so many other indigenous tribes, had no defense against the novel diseases introduced to the North American continent by European explorers, which beset the Wyandot beginning in the mid-1500s with the arrival of French explorers.
And you may have a village, when Cartier first showed up, he said, oh, there were 35,000. And then within a year, everything they brought from Europe, we were reduced by half. And then we had another plague sweep through, which reduced us by another half.
The Wyandot then encountered further calamity in the mid-1600s, when a conflict with their one-time friends, the Seneca, one of the five nations of the Iroquois Confederacy, forced the Wyandot to flee their homelands and become transient refugees for nearly half a century. This displacement would ultimately lead many Wyandot to find refuge and settle in what is now Upper Sandusky in Northwest Ohio.
And at one point, we even lived over in New York, right next door to the Seneca. They were our best friends. And then there are a number of different stories, one of which involves love and murder. Basically, a young lady, a Seneca girl, she wants to marry a young man. And the war chief said, no, absolutely not. So she's heartbroken, but she puts the word out. She'll marry anyone that will do her one favor, no questions asked, and they can't refuse. Well, a young Wyandot man, he agreed. He fell in love with her and they got married. And she says, okay, you have to do my favor. And he's like, yeah, sure, anything. He goes, kill the war chief. That tends to cause problems when you kill a person in authority. So he did, and they fled. Well, of course, the Seneca are very angry and they pursued us. And we went over around Niagara to that area. And then they came again. So we ended up over in that land between the lakes. So about 1649, you had the Five Nations at the time. The Seneca got some of them to join them. And anyway, they pursued us and eventually started attacking. And we fled. Some of us fled west on the lakes in our canoes, the waterways. And then some went north to Quebec to be with the French and sought protection with them. Those are our cousins, the Huron-Wendat. We're Wendat, but they are Wendat. So anyway, but they are our cousins distantly. But we went and we fled. I mean, we went to Christian Island and Mackinac Island and everywhere they kept finding us. Eventually, we end all the way over at Green Bay. And we thought, okay, well, we need to strike out. We need to find somewhere to live here. And then we ran into the Lakota. And that did not go well for us at all. So eventually, after more wanderings, we end up over back on Mackinac Island. In 1701, Cadillac came, asked us to move to Detroit. Well, we stayed on the opposite side of the river from Detroit initially. And then eventually they started moving Port Detroit. And anyway, we were there. And then sometime in the 1720s, 1730s, we kind of got tired of the French and the way they were running things and the missionaries. And it was just, it got kind of tiresome. So a large number of them moved to Ohio. Ohio had been occupied by the Erie people, and eventually they were either all killed or absorbed into the Haudenosaunee. So Ohio was empty. There was no one there. So we moved a large number because we couldn't go back to present-day Ontario. We'll even call it Wendake, which means the place of the Wyandot. So we made a life in Ohio, and eventually Upper Sandusky became the heart of the Wyandot people. There were still some in Michigan. I mean, all the way to the War of 1812, there were some in Michigan, including some of my family, two of my grandfathers. So there were chiefs in Detroit and chiefs in Upper Sandusky. But those are our homelands. That's how we ended up in Ohio and even some in Michigan.
It was during their time living among the French in Detroit in the early 1700s that the Wyandot first began to incorporate certain European influences they found useful into their culture.
Our time with the French, things started changing a little bit. We started adopting a little more of a European style. But when we went to Ohio, we had longhouses still. We still lived in that communal way. And eventually, people started to build log cabins because it's easier to maintain a home like that. Because with the elm bark that the longhouses are made out of, things happen. It gets damaged, and fire is a huge danger. So, yeah, it just made more sense to adopt these European ways. And then some of the early ones were like longhouses, just smaller. And then eventually, you had individual families, and then eventually, regular frame houses. There's a lot of those in Ohio. Matter of fact, several still exist that were owned by Wyandot people. We still had a council house. We still had ceremony, but we weren't afraid to change because it would make our lives easier and production would be increased.
The aptitude of the Wyandot for adaptation and resiliency in the face of great change enabled them to successfully make a new life for themselves in Upper Sandusky and to establish territory spanning across and even beyond the present-day state of Ohio, before eventually welcoming other indigenous nations who had also been displaced from their homelands to settle there.
The Wyandot at one time possessed all of Ohio, western Pennsylvania, eastern Indiana. We were the only game in town, more or less. At one time, the Miamia, or the Miama, they needed a place to live. We said, come live here. The Shawnee needed a place to live because they were kind of wanderers. They were everywhere. Here, we'll give you some land. And then the Delaware, come live near us. The Delaware are the only ones, to my knowledge, we never, ever had a fight with, ever. The Delaware referred to the Wyandot as uncle. They were our closest friends, allies, more comrades, because an ally can always drop you whenever things look bad. The Delaware were not like that.
For all the indigenous tribes who came to call Ohio home in the 1700s, not just the Delaware, the Wyandot were looked to as respected leaders and wise mediators, especially on matters of great importance that could impact the balance of power in the Ohio country.
The Wyandots are referred to as the keepers of the Council Fire. There were a number of tribes in Ohio that came to us to settle disputes. If there was war to be conducted, they came to the Wyandot. A lot of people came to Brownstown in Michigan to the Council House, and there were a lot of discussions held there about what are we going to do. And then even Upper Sandusky, they would come there. So we were pretty well respected.
The Wyandot was the most respected tribe. If you look at where they always lived, at least since the 1720s, they're on U.S. 23. That's the old Wyandotte Warrior Road. But they're also on the Great Trail that's coming out from Pittsburgh. They knew everything. If you wanted to even get into a war in the old days, you had to go to the Wyandotte. They had to give their okay. They had a leadership that was very outward-looking, and they were tremendous people.
But by the mid-1700s, the Ohio country had become a contested ground where the territorial claims of the Wyandotte and the other Ohio tribes and the colonial ambitions of Great Britain and France would clash.
Well, this country that we live in, the Ohio country, which many people consider quite dull and flyover, was a contested ground. It was a place that's perfect if you're a hunter, if you're a farmer, if you want to build towns. It's just spectacular, beautiful country, maybe the best in the world. About 1700, 1720, suddenly the Iroquois let go and everybody comes in at once. The French say, we've claimed it, it's ours. The Virginians say, we've claimed it, it's ours. The Wyandotte come in first, being chased by the Iroquois. They allow other tribes like the Shawnee, the Mingo, the Delaware, Ottawa, and Miami to live with them. We're not going to live in peace together. We all arrive at the same time, and we want this country for ourselves and for what we need.
Competing claims to the Ohio country from French and British colonies became the inciting conflict for the outbreak of the French and Indian War on the North American continent in 1754. The British defeated the French in 1763 and thereafter became the dominant colonial power in North America. But just over a decade later, Great Britain's colonial dominion would again be challenged, this time by its own American colonists, with the outbreak of the American Revolutionary War. Caught in the middle of these major military conflicts between European and American colonial powers, and determined to defend their own claims to the Ohio country, the Wyandotte and the other Ohio tribes had no choice but to choose sides and become combatants in these wars themselves.
French and Indian War, we sided with the French. We fought quite a lot. Most of the things that happened in the West that did involve us very much so, fighting the British.
Many wars are fought. French and Indian War breaks out in the 1750s. Pontiac's Rebellion, Lord Dunmore's War, and then the fourth big war, the American Revolution. Now, we think of the American Revolution as an East Coast thing. We think of the American Revolution, rightly so, as this spectacular awareness that we don't have to be in the British Empire. We don't have to have a king. We don't have to have aristocracy. The people at the bottom can rule. But if we form a nation, we need land for people. And we need to grow. And we need the Ohio country. We've got to cross the Appalachians and get to Ohio. So one of the causes and the main thing the United States fought for was we want the West. We want Ohio. It's our country. The tribes who are living here say no. The Wyandotte and the Shawnee and the Miami, the Ottawa, they join with the British who say, no, this is our country.
The Revolutionary War, we sided with the British. We'd been promised things like no Americans, no European, no one would move west of the Alleghenies. The rest, that's yours. So of course we're going to fight with the British.
And the British join with Canadian militia and loyalists like the Mohawks, like New York colonists who come all the way from the Mohawk River Valley, and they form a huge army. And I know we all know about Brandywine and Bunker Hill and Saratoga and Yorktown and the fight on the East Coast. Brutal fighting out here in the Ohio country as this huge Allied army of British and the Indians fight against young Americans and starting this great republic. Brutal warfare, that combined army of British and Indians generally attacked Kentucky settlements. People from Virginia, Kentucky came back and attacked mainly Shawnee settlements. And it was a fight to the finish until finally the United States of America wins the American Revolution. And at the negotiating table in Paris in 1783, the British say, we give up. You may have all the land from the Appalachians out to the Mississippi, including Ohio. Now, did they believe that? No.
In the wake of their defeat in the Revolutionary War in 1783, the British still had no intention of permanently ceding the Ohio country to the Americans. For the Americans, however, the land the British had surrendered to them in the Treaty of Paris clearly encompassed the Ohio Country, which they now looked to as the first theater of the young United States' westward expansion across North America. Codified in the signing of the Land Ordinance of 1785 and the Northwest Ordinance of 1787.
United States wants to open Ohio for settlement. We're going to subdivide the country, 6 mile by 6 mile square townships. Open it for settlement. Open it all for statehood. The American nation, the American dream goes west. There's not going to be any slavery north of the Ohio River. This is where the experiment really takes hold.
Part of that experiment involved the attempted implementation of the Indian policy set forth by the first U.S. president, George Washington, which recognized that the Wyandot and other indigenous tribes still had a rightful claim to the Ohio Country.
George Washington's interesting. He becomes president in 1789. He's like, I know you guys have a claim to this land. I know you have a claim to it. My policy is I want to buy the land from you, not just once, but yearly. I'm going to give you annuities and trade with us, live in peace with us. And he thought in 20 years we'd all merge together as one nation. That was his attitude.
Washington also believed that the United States already held legal title to at least the southern half of Ohio, based on the terms of the treaties of Fort Stanwix in New York, Fort McIntosh in Pennsylvania, and Fort Finney and Fort Harmer in Ohio, which the Americans had negotiated between 1784 and 1789 with various representatives of several eastern indigenous tribes, including the tribes now residing in the Ohio Country.
The eastern tribes had signed four major treaties, which allowed the United States to move halfway into Ohio. So imagine the current state of Ohio and divide it right through the center from east to west with a line. The U.S. can settle up to that line. Tribes settled to the north. The Indians just said, we're not going to obey those treaties.
The Wyandot and the other Ohio tribes, now bound together as a mighty confederation to defend their interests in the Ohio Country, considered those treaties to be illegitimate, having been signed under coercion and pressure from American military forces by tribal representatives who were not authorized to speak for their people on such matters. Nor had the tribes been included in the peace negotiations between Great Britain and the United States at the end of the Revolutionary War, despite those negotiations dealing directly with the rights to their own Ohio homelands.
They signed with chiefs that weren't even ours, or they were like clan chiefs or somebody just looking out for themselves. So the Americans were like, oh, well, we got this land. They just started letting people go and do whatever.
Contrary to American assumptions, the tribes believed the Ohio River to be the rightful boundary line separating Indian and American territory. As American surveyors and settlers began crossing the river into Ohio, the tribes, under the leadership of the great Miami war chief, Little Turtle, began to resist what they viewed as an invasion of their territory with a violent ferocity that spread shock and terror through the American Republic.
In the 1780s and 90s, people were getting killed. They were raiding, they were capturing people, and people were just astonished that we would kill women and children. It's like, well, children grow up and they don't forget. If a woman wants to fight, she can kill you as easily as a man. So that's why that was done sometimes, but they didn't want somebody that was weak either.
This outbreak of violence on the Ohio frontier ignited what has come to be known as the Northwest Indian War, a decade-long conflict between the United States and the Northwest Indian Confederacy, backed by their British allies, over the fate of the Ohio Country.
And the attitude of the Indians, now led by Little Turtle, is, if we unite and we've got the backing of the British, we can keep the Americans south of the Ohio. And this relationship we have with the British will be fine. British are fine with that, too. They're telling George Washington, never heard of the Indians in the Ohio Country. What are you talking about? And behind the scenes, when you read their papers and their letters, Washington's on to us. He knows that we're united in this effort. The British haven't left their forts. So the British are in Detroit, they're in Mackinac, Oswego, Niagara. And the goal is this nation that they have slowly formed, which is going to become Canada. Why can't it sweep down to the Ohio River? The war is going to go on. Anthony Wayne often said, the American Revolution ends on the East Coast in 1783, but it continues in the West until well into the 1790s. And what's the fight? For the British, Indian allies like the Wyandot, No, we're going to try to keep the Americans east of the Appalachians. And if we can't keep them east of the Appalachians, we're going to keep them south of the Ohio. This is our country. So it's a continental war of nationhood on both sides.
As the war dragged on in a series of sporadic skirmishes and brutal battles, some of which resulted in catastrophic American defeats at the hands of the Northwest Indian Confederation, the United States attempted to negotiate an end to the hostilities, even offering to agree to the Ohio River boundary if the tribes would allow those Americans who had already settled in the Ohio country to remain there, in exchange for which the American government would pay the tribes large sums of money on an annual basis. In the summer of 1793, the tribes met in council at the foot of the Maumee Rapids, near what would later become the site of Fort Meigs in present-day Perrysburg, to consider Washington's offer. In mid-August 1793, the Confederation sent two Wyandotte runners to deliver their answer to the awaiting American commissioners in Detroit.
To the commissioners of the United States, brothers, we have received your speech dated the 31st of last month, and it has been interpreted to all the different nations. We have been long in sending you an answer because of the great importance of the subject, but we now answer it fully, having given it all the consideration in our power. Brothers, a general council of all the Indian Confederacy was held, as you well know, in the fall of the year 1788 at this place, and that general council was invited by your commissioner, Governor St. Clair, to meet him for the purpose of holding a treaty with regard to the lands mentioned by you to have been ceded by the treaties of Fort Stanwix and Fort McIntosh. Brothers, we are in possession of the speeches and letters which passed on that occasion between those deputed by the Confederate Indians and Governor St. Clair, the Commissioner of the United States. These papers prove that your said commissioner, in the beginning of the year 1789, after having been informed by the General Council of the preceding fall that no bargain or sale of any part of these Indian lands would be considered as valid or binding unless agreed to by a General Council, nevertheless persisted in collecting together a few chiefs of two or three nations only, and with them held a treaty for the cession of an immense country in which they were no more interested than as a branch of the General Confederacy, and who were in no manner authorized to make any grant or cession whatever. Brothers, how then was it possible for you to expect to enjoy peace and quietly to hold these lands when your commissioner was informed, long before he held the Treaty of Fort Harmer, that the consent of a general council was absolutely necessary to convey any part of these lands to the United States? Brothers, you have talked to us about concessions. It appears strange that you should expect any from us who have only been defending our just rights against your invasions. We want peace. Restore to us our country, and we shall be enemies no longer. Brothers, you make one concession to us by offering us your money, and another by having agreed to do us justice after having long and injuriously withheld it. We mean in the acknowledgement that you have now made that the King of England never did, nor ever had a right to give you our country by the Treaty of Peace. And you want to make this act of common justice a great part of your concession, and seem to expect that because you have at last acknowledged our independence, we should for such a favor surrender to you our country. Brothers, you have talked also a great deal about preemption and your exclusive right to purchase Indian lands as ceded to you by the King at the Treaty of Peace. Brothers, we never made any agreement with the King, nor with any other nation, that we would give to either the exclusive right of purchasing our lands, and we declare to you that we consider ourselves free to make any bargain or cession of lands whenever and to whomsoever we please. If the white people, as you say, made a treaty that none of them but the King should purchase of us, and that he has given that right to the United States, it is an affair which concerns you and him, and not us. We have never parted with such a power. Brothers, we desire you to consider that our only demand is the peaceable possession of a small part of our once great country. Look back and review the lands from whence we have been driven to this spot. We can retreat no farther because the country behind hardly affords food for its present inhabitants, and we have therefore resolved to leave our bones in this small place to which we are now confined. Brothers, we shall be persuaded that you mean to do us justice if you agree that Ohio shall remain the boundary line between us.
To the chiefs and warriors of the Indian nations assembled at the foot of the Miami Rapids, brothers, We have just received your answer, dated the 13th instant, to our speech of the 31st of last month, which we delivered to your deputies at this place. You say it was interpreted to all your nations, and we presume it was fully understood. We therein explicitly declare to you that it was now impossible to make the River Ohio the boundary between your lands and the lands of the United States. Your answer amounts to a declaration that you will agree to no other boundary than the Ohio. The negotiation is therefore at an end. We sincerely regret that peace is not the result, but knowing the upright and liberal views of the United States, which, as far as you gave us an opportunity, we have explained to you, we trust that impartial judges will not attribute the continuance of the war to them. Done at the mouth of the Detroit River, the 16th day of August, 1793. Benjamin Lincoln, Beverly Randolph, Timothy Pickering, Commissioners of the United States.
Washington keeps negotiating with Little Turtle, with all the tribes. The negotiations break down. They can't get peace. So he also raises armies to send those armies in. Two are defeated. Harmer's defeated in 1790, St. Clair in 1791. And when he's really desperate, he comes looking for Anthony Wayne.
General Anthony Wayne, who had earned the nickname Mad Anthony during the American Revolutionary War for his often unconventional military tactics, risky and aggressive exploits, and wild temper, was now recalled from civilian life by President George Washington to take command of the American Legion on the Ohio frontier. He was to rebuild the Legion and train his men so that they might truly be prepared to withstand the ferocity and cunning of the warriors of the Northwest Indian Confederacy. Above all, Wayne was tasked with securing for the United States the treaty line to which Ohio's indigenous nations had ostensibly agreed in the treaties of Fort McIntosh, Finney, and Harmer. In the wake of the disastrous defeats of Generals Josiah Harmer and Anthony St. Clair by the Ohio tribes, it seemed an impossible task. And by this point in his life, Wayne had become something of a broken man who had come to detest war, which he called this horrid trade of blood.
When Wayne comes to fight in 1792, 3, and 4, he has an objective on the ground. It's, I'm fighting for that treaty line. And my book, Unlikely General, to me was one of the great stunning things I learned about Wayne was how unmad he was, how sane he was, how he recognized how powerful the Indians were, that the U.S. was weak. And he said, I don't think we can win. I think they're great soldiers, great diplomats. But it took him 2 years to pull his army together. And Wayne is told, get up to, not far from here, get up to Fort Miami's, a British fort, and take on this coalition. And he wins at Fallen Timbers. But to him, the great thing was the Treaty of Greenville. He gets that in 1795. When he defeats the Indians, he said, come in, please agree to that treaty. You agreed to this line many times.
In the aftermath of Anthony Wayne's decisive victory against the Indian Confederacy at the Battle of Fallen Timbers in present-day Maumee in August of 1794, Wayne repeatedly appealed to the tribal chiefs to come and sue for peace with the Americans. Finally, in the summer of 1795, the chiefs, having been all but abandoned by the British and watching their people suffer under increasingly desperate circumstances, agreed to meet with Wayne at Fort Greenville. On June 15, 1795, Wayne lit the council fire at Fort Greenville and opened the treaty negotiations with Ohio's Indian nations. One by one, the great chiefs of the Ohio tribes arrived, accompanied by contingents of warriors, to participate in the negotiations. In leading the negotiations for the United States, Wayne's only conditions for peace to be achieved were that the long-pursued treaty line in Ohio must at last be agreed to, and all American captives must be returned. Should the Indian nations agree to these terms, they would receive annual payments from the American government, and all else that had transpired throughout the duration of the war would be forgiven. Permit me now, Wayne had pleaded in his communications to the tribes leading up to the negotiations, to draw a veil over the late transaction, and to bring in deep oblivion and to obliterate from the mind all remembrance of past injuries. As the most respected chief of the grandfathers of Ohio's indigenous nations, It was Tarhe the Crane of the Wyandot, who ultimately carried the most influence among the tribes in determining the course of the negotiations. In the face of opposition from some other chiefs, like Little Turtle, who wanted to continue fighting, Tarhe the Crane insisted that the violence and bloodshed between the Indians and the Americans in the Ohio country must end. The Ohio Treaty Line must be agreed to.
Elder Brother, now listen to us. The Great Spirit above has appointed this day for us to meet together. I shall now deliver my sentiments to you, the 15 fires. I view you lying in a gore of blood. It is me, an Indian, who has caused it. Our tomahawk yet remains in your head. The English gave it to me to place there. Elder Brother, I now take the tomahawk out of your head, but with so much care that you shall not feel pain or injury. I will now tear a big tree up by the roots and throw the hatchet into the cavity with which they occupied, where the waters will wash it away, where it can never be found. Now I have buried the hatchet, and I expect that none of my color will ever find it out. I now tell you that no one in particular can justly claim this ground. It belongs, in common, to us all. No earthly being has an exclusive right to it. The Great Spirit above is the true and only owner of this soil, and he has given us all an equal right to it. Brothers, the 15 United States, listen. And you, my nephews, the Delawares. Brothers, Ottawas, Chippewas, Potawatomis, Shawnees, and Miamis. This is the day the Great Spirit has appointed for us, wherein we have completed the good work of peace. We have opened our ears, and we all understand well what has just now been said. We have paid the utmost attention to all your words in describing the boundary between the United States and us Indians, and the roads that you have made, which shall lead through our country to the different posts and reservations you have mentioned. We thank you for your information, and we are persuaded you have acted with great equity and moderation in dividing the country as you have done. We are all highly pleased with your humanity towards us. Listen, you, chiefs and warriors present. Our elder brother has made proposals to us, which require the greatest deliberation among us all. I do now request of you to consult upon this business without delay, that we may be enabled to return an answer to our brother tomorrow. Make no delay in deciding. That is all I have to say.
Our chief Tarhe, one of the greatest of all the Wyandot chiefs, in my opinion, there were 13 Wyandot chiefs at the Battle of Fallen Timbers. 12 of them were killed. Tarhe was the only remaining one. He'd received a really nasty wound in one of his elbows, and that arm was not of much use the rest of his days, but he still fought. But anyway, he knew the Americans would destroy us. They would eliminate all the natives if we didn't go along, if we didn't sign away 2/3 to 3/4 of our land. He knew that if we didn't, it would go bad. It'd be horrible. The Miamia chief, Little Turtle, he disagreed. He wanted to continue to fight, and Charhe's like, you can't do this. This is what's going to happen. And the Delaware said, our uncle, the Wyandots, will speak for us because we agree with them. So Tarhe made the agreement, and even Little Turtle begrudgingly said, fine. He goes, I'll be the last one to sign the document, and I'll be the last one to break it. So that's the way that happened. He made sure that everybody agreed to continue our existence, somewhat as we knew it.
Under Tarhe the Crane's leadership, on August 3, 1795, the Ohio tribes signed the Treaty of Greenville with the United States, allowing the Americans to settle halfway into Ohio and finally ending the Northwest Indian War.
Treaty of Greenville takes the state of Ohio, divides it east and west, north and south. United States can settle to the south, tribes to the north. They can go back and forth. You can travel into the other side's country, but you need to leave. You can't settle there permanently. Indians can come south and hunt. And that was a turning point out here in the Ohio country. That older generation of chiefs, like Little Turtle, Blue Jacket, Black Hoof, Tarhe the Crane of the Wyandot, they finally say the American Revolution's over. We ally with the U.S. now. We'll take your annuities. We'll live in peace. You guys can settle the southern part of Ohio. It's over the fighting. So it was a great treaty, they thought, on their part.
Brothers, listen, and you also, brothers of the different nations present. The Great Spirit above has appointed this day for us to complete all the good work in which we have been engaged. Now, this day, the good work is completed. I inform you all, brother Indians, that we do now and will henceforth acknowledge the 15 United States of America to be our father, and you all, for the future, look upon them as such. You must call them brothers no more. The Great Spirit has crowned them with success in all their undertakings. Father, you see we all now acknowledge you to be our father. I take you by the hand, which I offer as a pledge of our sincerity and our happiness in becoming your children. Father, now listen to your children, here assembled. Be strong now and take care of your little ones. See what a number you have suddenly acquired. Be careful of them and do not suffer them to be imposed upon. Don't show favor to one to the injury of any. An impartial father equally regards all his children, as well as those who are ordinary, as those who may be more handsome. Therefore, should any of your children come to you crying and in distress, have pity on them and relieve their wants. Now, all my brothers present, you see that we have acknowledged and called on the United States as our father. Be strong, brothers, and obedient to our father. Ever listen to him when he speaks to you and follow his advice. I now deliver this wampum in presence of you all as a token of our being now the children of the 15 fires.
It's meant to be, I don't think so much a permanent peace as a truce in this long and terrible war. And for 15 years, it brought a tremendous amount of peace into Ohio. And for the Americans, think about it, 1795, we're still fighting a war. By 1803, Ohio's in the Union. 60,000 people are here. And that's the ending, finally, of the American Revolution. 15 years of peace. Before somebody by the name of Tecumseh comes along.
In part two of this three-part series on the history of the Wyandot in Ohio.
Tecumseh, this young warrior, last to leave the battlefield at Fallen Timbers, he never accepts the Treaty of Greenville. And he says the Ohio country belongs to us, our nation state.
The Shawnee warrior Tecumseh begins building a new Northwest Indian Confederacy and aligns with the British to make one last stand in defiance of the United States' advance into Ohio, bringing about the War of 1812 and upending the uncertain peace that had existed on the Ohio frontier after the Treaty of Greenville.
His confederation leads in great measure to the War of 1812, a devastating war for the tribes. I don't think we historians have captured it yet. Tribes split in two.
When the War of 1812 rolled around, the Michigan Wyandot sided with Tecumseh, and they broke the Treaty of Greenville. And Tarhey and the Ohio Wyandot sided with the Americans because they'd signed an agreement.
And in the aftermath of America's victory in the war, a now unrestrained torrent of American settlement in the Ohio country forces Ohio's indigenous peoples onto diminished land reserves and further threatens their traditional ways of life.
The treaty at the foot of the rapids, the United States is buying most of Northwest Ohio. That treaty draws out reserves where the tribes are going to live. Now the Wyandot are angry because they said still not enough land.
It reduced us down to specks of land. That was really a pretty devastating treaty. So we ended up getting cut down further and further and further. It took all this land. Even though we'd been reduced, it just took it all away.
And yet, the Wyandot overcome these challenges and find a way to flourish on their Grand Reserve in Upper Sandusky, becoming among the most prosperous people in the state of Ohio and forging deep bonds of friendship with their white neighbors.
Overnight, they become a truly prosperous farming community that would be the envy of any farming community west of the Appalachians. They have beautiful peach and apple orchards. They have roads. They have a hotel. They are the U.S. Post Office in northwestern Ohio. They had intermarried with many settlers.
The farms and the orchards, there were professionals, doctors, lawyers. We were part of the community. We're prosperous here.
But after Andrew Jackson assumes the American presidency and signs the Indian Removal Act of 1830, the Wyandot must navigate a new existential threat and finally decide whether to leave Ohio, their home for over 100 years, in order to ensure the survival of their people.
They had to make the decision themselves, but Jackson hired people to go out and negotiate treaties and do your best to convince these people to leave. One by one, the tribes themselves had to make the decisions on, do we go? They had a great deal of support in Ohio to stay.
It was a very hard decision, but natives are natives. Thank you, Andy Jackson. So That's just the way it was.
Deep thanks to Chris Houck from the Wyandot Nation of Oklahoma and Dr. Mary Stockwell, our guests for this episode of Storied Ground. Thanks also to our voice actors for this episode, Kari Marshall, Dylan Sickles, and, from the Wyandot Nation of Oklahoma, Chief Billy Friend and Tarhe the Crane descendant Joshua Garcia. I'm your host and producer, Nick Pavlik. Our executive producer is Chris Pfeiffer. If you have any questions, comments, or you want to listen again, go to wgte.org/ground or wherever you stream your podcasts. See you next time.
WGTE. Voices around us.
WGTE is supported in part by the American Rescue Plan Act funds, allocated by the City of Toledo and the Lucas County Commissioners, and administered by the Arts Commission.